Eve M. from Fort Lauderdale is our next speaker. She has been sober 45 years. I first met Eve as a staff member back in 66, but she was a staff member at GSO from 1951 to 1968. Eve has traveled all around the world for many years. She has seen AA working around the world. So please help me welcome Eve.
Hi, my name is Eve, and I'm a happy, joyous, and free alcoholic. How does an alcoholic ever get to be happy, joyous, and free? I'll tell you how. By living this wonderful program and this fellowship of the Spirit, this way of life, one day at a time. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. But I know now that I was always an alcoholic. Not before I started to drink. I don't know. I can't prove that. But I know because of what alcohol did for me, that I am one of those people for whom alcohol was important. Because from the very beginning, when I first drank, it filled up those terrible holes, that terrible emptiness, that awful feeling of not belonging, of there not being enough of being unlovable, of being full of fear, of not feeling that people would approve of me. But I didn't put that in those words. I was just kind of miserable during all of my growing up years. My mother had died when I was 12, and my father had three daughters, and I'm sure he tried very hard to be the best dad that he could, but there were some things he really didn't understand. He didn't quite understand what things were important to girls. And I know that we're not supposed to figure out why we got to be an alcoholic, but to accept the fact that we have this illness and that we can recover from it if we will take these wonderful 12 steps, which were read before the meeting and How It Works by Carl. And so although I don't say that it could have been a reason for my alcoholism, you could almost say it might be. I was the only girl in the freshman class at Vassar College in 1924 at age 16 with cotton underwear. The rest of them had silk. One of the reasons that distinguished me and made me feel apart from instead of a part of, I never felt that I had that feeling of belonging. I didn't do very well at college. I didn't drink. This is back in the Prohibition era. 1924 is a few years ago, kiddos. And in case you haven't added up, I was 16 in 1924. I'm 82 now. So. I didn't drink during my first couple of years of college because I was afraid. I was afraid of almost everything. I was afraid, as I said, of not belonging, of not being lovable, and all the rest of it. But I was also afraid of what alcohol might do to me. I think probably I recognized the fact that I would lose control, not realizing how important having control was going to be to me later on. So I didn't take a drink until I went to Europe at the end of my sophomore year. But I didn't wait till I got to Europe. 12 miles out on the ship, they began to serve. And the person next to me ordered an orange blossom. I didn't know what to order. And so I ordered an orange blossom. and I drank it. And that's when it happened. That's when the magic occurred. Because all of a sudden, instead of being this huge, giant, homely, big nose, all awkward, elbows, knees, you name it, terrible person, suddenly I was eyes of blue, 5'2", and adorable. And so I had found, I thought, the answer. I found the answer. I think I used alcohol always from then on to cope. They talk about escape. I don't know. I needed it to cope. I needed it to cope with life. And I coped so damn well that when I got out back to Vassar that year, I drank on the campus, got caught, and was kicked out. And I felt terrible. But I really hadn't belonged at college. And so I decided that I was going to go on with my career. I knew that I was going to be an actress. I was going to be, of course, a great star. And you see, that's one of those things I didn't understand then that I have learned to understand in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't understand my motivation. I realized after I got sober and got an AA and began to work on the fourth step that my motivation was not necessarily to be a fine technician, a fine actress, to study all the things I needed to in order to achieve that goal. Heavens no. My goal was instant stardom, so that people would come up to me and tell me how wonderful I was. And I think that's one of the things that happens with so many of us. We strive to be perfectionists so that people will approve of us. Because I felt that if somebody came and told me I was okay, that I was wonderful, that I was good, or whatever, that then I could believe it myself. Because I didn't. I felt so insecure. I felt so unsure of myself. And so unable to communicate. That's one of the joys, one of the gifts in AA, this ability we have now to communicate with one another, to share on the basis of love, something that I could never do during my growing up years. And so from then on, I was an alcoholic. I left the theater. My uncle, who had the company I was in, was very kind. After about 8 years, he said, "My dear, I'm afraid we don't have parts big enough for you next year." And so, my wonderful theatrical career as a star was over before it started. I forgot to mention that I'd started doing something else we alcoholics are prone to do. I'd started getting married. I had a wonderful, wonderful little boy by that marriage. The marriage didn't last. And from then on, things were rather difficult. And I can recall now, I had a wonderful old Methodist grandmother up in New Britain, Connecticut. And when I started to smoke, she was very much upset. And she used to sort of drum her hands on this old mission rocker to make her points. And she looked at me and said, "My dear, smoking leads to drinking. And drinking leads to prostitution." I never got paid. But I did start getting married again. But this time I thought I would pick more wisely. And so I picked a man who drank the same way I did. I was so tired of being criticized for drinking, for getting drunk, for falling down, for being obscene, for doing the things we do. And so when I found a man who drank the same way I did, I thought I'd found heaven. And we fell in love, and it was wonderful. We got married, and I thought life was going to be beautiful because we really had a lot going for us. We did love each other. He was a brilliant guy. I, of course, was a brilliant girl. A little more brilliant than he, naturally. Because at that time I was a bit of a of an art snob, and he'd been a big radio announcer. So that let him be acceptable to me, because I was at the theater, even though I wasn't doing anything. Of course, I failed to recognize the fact that he was working for $25 a week in his family's business because he was unemployable as a radio announcer. But who cares about things like that? And so we got married, and we had two beautiful children, two beautiful little girls, and my son from my other marriage came to live with us, and I thought it was going to be wonderful. And of course, alcohol was in the way. Because we were both alcoholics, neither one of us knew anything about alcoholism. I knew there was something wrong with him, but of course that gave me further wonderful excuses for my own drinking. Because we always have to blame something else. And people would come to me and say, oh, either you're drinking more than you used to. And I would pull down that curtain of memory and forget that I'd been kicked out of Vassar, forget that I'd landed in a jail in Providence, Rhode Island for drunken disorderly conduct. I'm grateful for blackouts, by the way. I don't want to know how that happened. And so I would blame him. I would say, yes, of course, I can't stand living with this SOB if I don't drink with him. And so I had an excuse for my drinking. But I began to sense there was something wrong. And most basically of all, there was something terribly wrong with me inside. I hated myself. I adored my children. I still do. And thank God I have a wonderful relationship with them. I loved them so much, and I saw myself doing these sins of omission rather than sins of commission, perhaps. But nonetheless, I felt degraded inside. I felt remorseful. I felt guilt. I felt shame. Why couldn't I stop? I hated drinking. I really didn't like to drink. I really didn't like the taste of it. But of course, I was an alcoholic, and I drank for the effect and for what it would do for me. And so I went on with it. And things, of course, got worse and worse. They got worse and worse. And I remember my son one night said to me, oh, Mother, he was about 14 at the time. He said, I can't stand to come home and watch you get drunk every night. And he had big brown eyes. And I looked at them, and I couldn't see any love there. I saw hurt. I saw despair. And I saw fear. And I didn't know what to do. I'd read the Jack Alexander piece in 41, March 1st, 1941, and I thought how wonderful it would be for Roger. I mean, he's the alcoholic, my husband. But he wasn't interested, and so I felt that I had to go on drinking. But fortunately, finally, my fear of going on drinking became greater than my fear of trying to live without it. And I kind of think that's the point that we have to reach, where that fear outweighs the other one, because fear had been a motivating factor in my life. On top of that, my mother-in-law had come to see us and was very distressed, and she left a little note on the refrigerator in which she said, my dear children, the world frowns upon inebriates. Inebriate. If any of you don't like the word alcoholic, try inebriate. She went on to say that she'd written to the Alcoholic Foundation, which, as Mike Alexander explained upon Friday night, was the forerunner of the General Service Office of AA. And they sent me some literature. It was a little pamphlet and had one woman's story in it. And I read that, and for the first time I felt that maybe I wasn't alone. There was somebody else, somewhere, who hurt the way I hurt, who felt the fear, the shame, the degradation, and the despair that I felt. And I felt that this would be an answer for me. But I was so frightened I didn't dare go alone. Roger wouldn't go with me. And so I told my son that I would never drink again. But I backed up that promise by saying I knew that if I couldn't do it alone, I would go to AA. And of course, I couldn't do it alone. And so a few months later, drinking around the clock, unable to stop, terrified and in despair, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went down to the old 24th Street Clubhouse, 324 and a half West 24th Street. We never knew what the other half was, but that was the address. And there was a long, dark hall that led into the building. And I could see at the end of this hall, there was a room with light. And I could hear laughter. And I was terrified. And I thought, I can't do this. I can't walk in there and see all these strangers. What will they think of me? You know, that terrible ego, that sickness of the ego that we seem to have. But I finally walked that hall. I found out later they called it the last mile. And I walked in, and there were people sitting around the room, and I went down and I talked with a young man, and he told me his story. And I began to feel a little better, and I began to tell him mine. And I remember he said, "You'll do. There's a meeting Thursday night. It's a closed business meeting, but you can be here." And there were only two meetings a week, and that was the only place for AA in the city of New York at that time, and that was October 1944. And so I didn't get sober then. And he'd been so kind, I thought I must tell him something else. So I said to him, "Dan, you've been so wonderful. I must be totally honest with you. There's something else I must tell you." I think he thought I was going to tell him I had committed murder. I said, "I have an inferiority complex. And he laughed just the way you did. And you know how I got, all uptight. "Son of a bitch, I'm going to get out of here, you know." And then he called over to the other people in the room the same thing, and I realized they were laughing with love. And that was my first experience of recognizing the fact that I was no longer special. I might be unique, but I'm not special. We're all unique. There's only one of us like us anywhere. And so I began the beautiful journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so grateful that I had an opportunity to go to meetings in that old 24th Street Club before I slipped around in December, so that January 6, 1945 is my sobriety date. And what a wonderful journey it's been. It's been said so many times at this wonderful conference, at this convention, that has been so magnificent, and I think we all owe a great debt of gratitude to the gals who have helped put this on, the people at General Service, the wonderful staff, the host committee here in Washington, and even the people in the kingdom. It seems to me they've really put themselves out for us. It's been magnificent. I think we owe them a lot of gratitude. And so I started to try and walk this walk. But I was so full of fear, I found it very hard to let you in. I didn't realize that I needed desperately that prayer that we find in the chapter in the big book on the third step, where it says, "Relieve me of the bondage of self." I was so sick, that bondage of self was so tremendous. Everything was in on me. And I couldn't receive all the love that you were passing on to me. I was so had such a wall around me. I was so fearful of rejection. My ego was so sick that it would take me a long time. It took me a long time to let down those barriers, to leave my shield outside the door, and to come into AA and begin to really share and to begin to change. That willingness to change was a little time coming. But how important that is, because that really is what we have to do. Is to learn who we are, what we need to change, what can be improved. And of course, mostly it's a change of attitude. There's not much we can change sometimes about ourselves. I couldn't change the fact that I'm tall and that I had a big nose, but I could change the way I felt about those things. You know, for years I wanted to have a nose job. It's a good thing I didn't. Now it holds my glasses up. And so I began to be able to learn to look at me and know who I was. Not only to look at me, but to understand my motivation. I think the fourth step is a wonderful step, because we don't really know who we are. We have such misconceptions about ourselves. And to be able to finally know that I am who I am. You know, we try so hard to be somebody. I wanted to be famous. I needed to be somebody. For God's sake, we are somebody, even if we're nobody. Learn that. Know that. And so I slowly began to grow in the wonderful AA program. Roger and I were divorced after about 6 years of my sobriety and his being drunk every night. But I knew that I wasn't growing the way I wanted to. I knew the children were being hurt. And once he left, we could do more sharing of AA in our home, because he didn't want AA anywhere near him. And so once he left, we began to share AA. And I'm so glad that I learned that. And sometimes we learn things by a strange set of circumstances. I had been rather confused about what I should tell my little girls about these meetings that I went to. And so I was sort of delaying telling them and explaining to them. And one night my little girl came home from school and said, my older little girl, Ruthie, she came in and she said, Mommy, we had to do a play for school. I'd like to read it to you. And I said, fine, honey, read it. Well, she said, it's about Thanksgiving. And I said, good. And she said, well, she said, I'm going to use the girls' names because they'll each be playing themselves. And I said, fine. Well, she said, and she started and she read along and said, Diana says, my grandparents are coming to our house for Thanksgiving. And Jody says, well, we're going to go to my grandparents for Thanksgiving. And then I say, we're having an early dinner because my mommy has to go to an AA meeting. And Zogam Den and I, we were able to share really this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, this program of living, these 12 steps. I had no trouble knowing I was an alcoholic. I was so grateful to know that I had an illness that was semi-respectable. At least I wasn't a degenerate. I wasn't a moral leper. I wasn't insane. And of course, I knew that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, because I knew that I was insane. The fact that I would ever pick up a drink was a mark of my insanity. And the third step I had to do a lot of work with. I had to get my sick ego out of the way, because I couldn't turn it over. I still had to be in control. And the 11th step was a big help to me in working that out. And then with the fourth step, with my children, we worked together on things. We discussed things. We shared. And they grew up in the AA program. And at one point, my older daughter came to me and said, oh, Mommy, I know what I want to be when I grow up. I want to be a ballet dancer and a member of AA. Of course, I know she didn't want the agony, she didn't want the fear, she didn't want the distress, she didn't want the pain. But she got it all, but she's also now got 13 years in an AA program. And my other daughter is in Al-Anon. She went to Al-Anon because she and her sister had such a terrible time together. Even when Ruthie first got sober, there was this terrible tension between these girls. They fought all the time. I hated to have them both in the house at once because they yelled and screamed and really sometimes even fisticuffs. Their anger and hostility was so tremendous. And then Liz went to Al-Anon. She went to Al-Anon and Ruthie grew in AA. And God bless Al-Anon. Now my two girls love each other. They're friends. So I began to try and grow in the AA program. I went to work as a volunteer at the intergroup office and eventually got to be secretary at the intergroup. All the time beginning to feel this more and more ability to share, to be able to communicate. to know that I could be of help to somebody, to try so hard to carry the message in the best way that I could. And I was so terrified of speaking. I didn't recognize the fact that that fear was one that I wouldn't be the greatest ever, you know. I couldn't be Marty Mann, so I wasn't going to talk at all. And so it took me a long time. But once I began to share, I began to know what the joy is in being able to communicate and in trying to help other alcoholics to find the kind of sobriety, the kind of joy of living that we have managed to find and do find in this fellowship of the Spirit, this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so life goes on. I went up to General Service. Fantastic experience to be at the heartbeat of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I look at these flags around here, 75. And I've watched AA grow around the world and visited AA in faraway places and seen how it grows and prospers. Once it's in the country itself, not just Americans sitting there, but people of the same culture, the same language, and watch it grow. And I remember once, when I first went to Japan, what a lesson I had, because I wanted to go to the meeting. I couldn't find it. I finally found the little church where the meetings were in Tokyo. And I asked the librarian, I said, is there an AA meeting here? She said, yes, upstairs. So I went upstairs, and there was a door that was closed, said third grade. Couldn't hear anything. Next door said second grade. Couldn't hear anything. Next door said first grade. Couldn't hear anything. Next door said kindergarten. I put my ear up to the door, and I heard, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And I thought, isn't that wonderful? That's true. We are in kindergarten because we're learning now. We're learning. We're learning not just how to stay sober, but how to live. How to live joyously. You know, it says in the big book in the family afterwards, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. To learn that there is a higher power, to learn how to communicate with our higher power. There is a divinity within that shapes our ends. Shakespeare said that. Matthew says, the Father within, he doeth the work. And Bill wrote in the big book, in the chapter to the agnostic, about the great inner reality. That wonderful sense of oneness that we get with our Creator. And that's why I always felt separate and apart. I had a separation from my Creator. I had a separation. I didn't feel that oneness. That oneness that we feel when we're here. You can't help but feel it in this room. You feel it in every AA meeting that you ever go to. And this is a wonderful, terrific, fantastic celebration. But you know, this is not just where we celebrate. We can celebrate every day of our lives. Alone. Alone with our higher power. With our own group. With a pigeon. With somebody we're trying to help. With our family. With the people we love. And I must inject here before I forget it, that that beautiful son of mine unfortunately went away to college before we began to share AA in our home. And we're friends, but it's not as close as I wish it were. But you know, my Al-Anon daughter always has something wise to say. And sometimes when I feel badly about Don, she says, Mommy, just remember, he doesn't have a program. And that's true. That's true. And so we can celebrate this program every day of our lives, in our own living, in the way in which we live. Because it is a celebration. This is a celebration. A magnificent one. A celebration of life. A celebration of spirit. And a celebration of love. But God is love, right here, right now.